The Butcher Bandit. Chapter 1. January 10th, 1906, Bisbee, Arizona. Anyone seeing an old derelict sot slowly swaying down Moon Avenue in Bisbee that afternoon would have mistaken him for what he was not. A man who had grown old before his time working the mines that ran through the mineral-rich mountains under the town. His shirt was grubby and he smelled unwashed. One suspender held up torn and ragged pants that were stuffed into scuffed and worn boots that should have been thrown in the trash gully behind the town long ago. Snarled and greasy hair straggled to his shoulders and merged with an uncut beard that hung halfway down his protruding stomach. He looked through eyes so dark brown they were nearly black. There was no expression in them. They seemed cold and almost evil. A pair of work gloves covered the hands that had never held a shovel or a pick. Under one arm, he carried an old gunny sack that appeared empty. Almost whimsically, the dirty burlap had Douglas Feed and Grain Company, Omaha, Nebraska, stenciled on it. The old man took a minute and parked on a bench at the corner of Moon Avenue and Tombstone Canyon Road. Behind him was a saloon, mostly empty because it was the middle of the day and its usual patrons were hard at work in the mines. The people walking and shopping in the little mining town paid him no more than a quick, disgusted glance. Whenever they passed, he pulled a whiskey bottle from a pant pocket and drank heavily before recapping it and putting it back. No one could have known it was not whiskey, but tea. It was warm for June. He guessed the temperature to be in the high 90s. He sat back and looked up and down the streets as a trolley car passed, pulled by an aging horse. Electric motored trolleys had yet to come to Bisbee. Most of the vehicles on the streets were still horse-drawn wagons and buggies. The town had only a handful of automobiles and delivery trucks, and none were in evidence. He knew enough about the town to know that it was founded in 1880 and named after Judge DeWitt Bisbee, one of the money men behind the Copper Queen Mine. A good-sized community, its population of 20,000 made it the largest city between San Francisco and St. Louis. Despite the many miners' families that lived in modest little wooden buildings, the main economy was based around saloons and a small army of shady ladies. The man's head nodded to his chest. He looked like a drunk who had dozed off. But it was an act. He was conscious of every movement around him. Occasionally, he glanced across the street at the Bisbee National Bank. He watched with interest, through half-closed eyes, as a truck with chain drive and solid tired wheels rattled up to the bank. There was only one guard who got out of the truck and carried a large bag of newly printed bills inside. A few minutes later, he was helped by the bank's teller to lug a heavy chest through the door and onto the truck. The man knew that it was a shipment of gold, a piece of the 3 million ounces that had been produced at the local mines. But gold was not what piqued his interest. It was too heavy and too risky for one man to dispose of. It was the cash that brought him to Bisbee, not the prized yellow metal. He watched as the truck moved away and two men, whom he had identified as security guards at the giant Phelps Dodge Mining Company, walked out of the bank. They had delivered the cash to pay the mining company payroll the following day. He smiled to himself, knowing the assets of the Bisbee National Bank had risen to a new level. He had watched the people who came and went from the bank for nearly 2 weeks until he could identify them by sight. He had also noted the time when they came and went. Satisfied now there was no one in the bank except one teller and the owner-manager, he looked at his watch and nodded to himself. Leisurely, The old derelict rows stretched and ambled across the brick street and trolley tracks to the bank, carrying the large empty gunny sack over one shoulder. Just as he was about to enter, a woman unexpectedly walked past. She gave him a look of loathing, stepped around him, and went inside. She was not in his plan, but he decided to deal with the matter rather than wait. He checked the street and followed her into the bank. He closed the door. The teller was in the vault, and the woman waited until he reappeared. The derelict removed a model 1902 Colt 38 caliber automatic from his boot, struck the woman on the nape of the neck with the barrel, watching with detachment as she slowly folded to the wooden floor. It happened so suddenly and silently that the owner of the bank did not see or hear anything from his office. Then the drunken miner suddenly turned bank robber, leaped spritefully over the counter, entered the owner's office, and put the gun barrel to his head. "Resist and you'll be shot dead," he said in a low but forbidding tone. "Now, call the teller into your office." The bald, fat, shocked bank owner looked at him with brown eyes widened with fright. Without argument, he called out, "Roy, come in here." "Be right there, Mr. Castle," Roy called out from inside the vault. "Tell him to leave the vault open," said the bank robber quietly, with a sharp edge to his voice. "Roy, don't close the vault door," Castle complied as ordered, his eyes crossing as they focused on the gun pressing against his forehead. Roy stepped from the vault, a ledger under one arm. He couldn't see the unconscious woman lying under the counter. Suspecting nothing, he entered Castle's office and abruptly stiffened when he saw the robber holding a gun to his boss's head. The robber pulled the gun barrel away from Castle's head and motioned with the muzzle toward the vault. "Both of you," he said calmly, "into the vault." There was no thought of resistance. Castle rose from his desk and led the way into the vault while the robber stepped quickly to the window to check the street for anyone heading for the bank. Except for a few women shopping and a passing beer wagon, the street was quiet. The interior of the vault was well lit, with an Edison brass lamp hanging from the steel ceiling. Except for the chest containing the gold, stacks of bills, mostly the payroll for the mining companies, covered the shelves. The robber threw the gunny sack at the teller. "Okay, Roy, fill it with all the greenbacks you have." Roy did as he was told. With trembling hands, he began sweeping the piles of bills of various denominations into the sack. By the time he was finished, the sack was stretched to the limit of its burlap fibers and seemed to be the size of a well-filled laundry bag. "Now, lay down on the floor," ordered the robber. Castle and Roy, believing the robber was now about to make his getaway, stretched out flat on the floor with their hands stretched over their heads. The robber pulled a heavy woolen scarf from one of his pockets and wrapped it around the muzzle of his automatic. Then he systematically shot both men in the head. It sounded more like two loud thumps than the sharp crack of gunfire. Without another second's hesitation, he heaved the sack over one shoulder and walked from the vault without looking back. Unfortunately, he wasn't finished. The woman under the counter moaned and tried to rise to her elbows. With utter indifference, he leaned down, lowered the gun, and shot her in the head like he had the bank owner and teller. There was no remorse, not the slightest hint of emotion. He didn't care whether any of them left families behind. He had murdered three defenseless people in cold blood with as little interest as he might have shown stepping on a column of ants. He paused to search for one of the shell casings he thought he'd heard fall to the floor from inside the scarf wrapped around the gun, but could not find it. He gave up and walked casually from the bank, noting with satisfaction that no one had heard the muted gunshots. With the gunny sack bulging with cash slung over his shoulder, the man walked through the alley running behind the bank. Stepping into a small alcove under a stairway where he would not be seen, he took off the grimy clothes, removed the gray wig and beard, and threw everything in a small valise. Now revealed in an expensively tailored suit, he perched a bowler hat at a jaunty angle on his head and its neatly brushed carpet of red hair. He slipped on a necktie and knotted it before also tossing the scuffed boots in the valise. He was a short man, and the soles and heels of the boot had been raised nearly 2 inches. Next, he pulled on a pair of English-made leather shoes with lifts in the heel to make him appear taller before turning his attention to a large leather suitcase he had hidden under a canvas tarp along with a Harley-Davidson motorcycle. Glancing up and down the alley every few seconds, he transferred the huge pile of cash from the gunny sack to the suitcase, which he strapped on a rack over the rear wheel of the motorcycle. The valise containing his disguise, he tied on a front rack. At that moment, the man heard shouting coming down the alley from Tombstone Canyon Road. Someone had discovered the bodies in the Bisbee National Bank. Unconcerned, he pushed the motorcycle forward and started the 3-horsepower, 25-cubic-inch, 1-cylinder engine. He threw one leg over the seat and rode deserted back alleys to the railroad yard. He moved unseen along a siding where a freight train had stopped to take on water. His timing was perfect. Another 5 minutes and the freight train would have moved back onto the main line and headed toward Tucson. Without being noticed by the engineer and the brakeman, as they pulled a big pipe down from a wooden tank into the tender for water to make steam, the man took a key from his vest pocket and opened the padlock to the door to a boxcar that was marked with a painted sign that read, O'Brien Furniture Company, Denver. He slid the door open on its rollers. The presence of the boxcar in this time and place was no coincidence. Acting as a fictitious representative of the equally fictitious O'Brien Furniture Company, he had paid cash for it to be included in the freight train passing through Bisbee en route from El Paso, Texas, to Tucson, Arizona. He took a wide plank, attached by brackets to the side of the boxcar, and used it as a ramp to ride the Harley-Davidson aboard. Then he quickly closed the rolling door and reached through a small hinged opening to replace the lock as the whistle on the engine tooted and the train began moving forward from the siding onto the main track. From the outside, the boxcar looked like any other that had been in use for several years. The paint was faded and the wooden sides were dented and chipped, but its appearance was deceptive. Even the lock on the door was fake, making it look like the car was buttoned up tight. It was the inside that was the most deceptive, however. Instead of an empty interior or one packed with furniture, it was luxurious, ornately constructed, and furnished as ostentatiously as any private rail car belonging to the president of a railroad. Mahogany paneling spread over the walls and ceiling. The floor was covered by a thick carpet. The decor and furniture were extravagantly magnificent. There was an opulent sitting room, a palatial bedroom, and an efficient kitchen with the latest innovations for preparing gourmet meals. There were no servants, porters, or cooks. The man worked alone, without accomplices who might reveal his true name and occupation. No one knew of his clandestine operations as a bank robber and mass murderer. Even the railroad car had been built and decorated in Canada before being secretly transported across the border into the United States. The robber relaxed in a plush leather settee, uncorked a bottle of 1884 Chateau Laurangeau Bordeaux, chilled in buckets, and poured himself a glass. He knew the town sheriff would quickly form a posse. But they would be looking for an old mangy miner who murdered while in a drunken fit. The posse would fan out, searching the town, almost certain he was too poor to own a horse. None of the townspeople had ever seen him come and go on horseback or driving a buggy. Immensely pleased with himself, he sipped the wine from a crystal glass and studied the leather suitcase. Was this his 15th, or was it his 16th successful robbery, he mused. The 38 men and women and 2 children he had killed never entered his mind. He estimated the take of the mining payroll at $325,000 to $330,000. Most robbers wouldn't have come close to guessing the amount inside the case. But it was easy for him, since he was a banker himself. The sheriff, his deputies, and the posse would never find the murdering robber. It was as if he had disappeared into thin air. No one ever thought to connect him with the dapper man riding through town on a motorcycle. The hideous crime would become one of Bisbee's most enduring mysteries.